Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My next guest is the legendary writer Tom Wolfe, here to discuss his new book, The Kingdom of Speech, which argues that speech, more than evolution, is responsible for human progress. Tom Wolfe's body of work as a journalist and essayist includes such books as The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, From Bauhaus to Our House, Radical Chic and Mau Mauing the Flat Catchers, The Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Streamline Baby, and more. As a novelist, The Bonfire of the Vanities is one of the archetypal New York works of fiction based on reality in the late 1980s, and so much more. Tom Wolfe, welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thank you, Brian.
What got you interested in writing about language and juxtaposing it against evolution?
I had given a talk back in 2006, and I entitled the talk "The Human Beast." It was really about social status, and I chose "The Human Beast" because my favorite novelist, Emile Zola, had written a book called "La Bête Humaine," the human beast, and then only to find out that the reason he had entitled this novel, in which there are four murderers murdering four people who don't have nothing to do with one another. And he'd gotten this idea that humans are beasts from Darwin. I never paid any attention to the theory of evolution. It was just one of those, the given, you know. And then I suddenly got interested in the theory of evolution, and I soon discovered it doesn't add up.
Wait, is Tom Wolfe now a creationist?
No, it's... I'm not a creationist. Denotes religion. That's no part of the picture for me. But the
So a certain part of evolution seemed not to add up for you,
right? There's nothing in any part of animal life that is even in any way leads toward speech. And because of speech, we really rule the entire world. There are almost no wild animals, except unless we put them in what we call preserves, and just to watch. And as soon as they cross the line of the preserve, they're dead. I came to the conclusion that speech is a technique that man invented. It had nothing to do with evolution, if there is indeed any such thing as evolution, and which is not subject to proof at all. It's actually a pretty silly idea, evolution. So that's how I got to that point.
It is a whole field of science, and I'm not familiar with it in detail, but there's a whole body of evolution that would be about how speech itself evolved, right?
I don't see any explanations in the theory of evolution about speech. In evolution doesn't meet any of the standard tests for an hypothesis, for example. One test is, did someone witness this happen and record it? Well, no, that really didn't take place. Can anyone replicate it the way you can replicate genetic research? No. Can you falsify it, come up with a set of facts that, if true, would make evolution?
Don't they replicate it in the lab with flies and all kinds of things?
Well, it's not evolution. You can create a different version of a certain fly, a different version of all kinds of species, but they never hop out of the species that they're in. And evolution is based on the notion that you can graduate from one
species
to another.
Next.
Yeah.
Your book is a critique not only of Darwin but also of Noam Chomsky. Now, that's Chomsky the linguist, not so much Noam Chomsky for his lefty politics, right?
Right. It's really him. And I think the two things are really separate. And one magnified the other, so he became, by the year 2000, he was one of the most famous people in the world, and certainly in the United States. As a matter of fact, at one point I called him Noam Charisma, because he had the ability to take over an entire field, linguistics, and make it, turn it into a physical theory that there's a language organ, and the language organ pushes the universal grammar through a deep structure, as he calls it, and it's picked up by the LAD, the language acquisition device. Unfortunately, none of these things can be found in the body. Where is the organ? Well, he says it's inside the brain. Well, we don't have an organ is something that is discrete. It's by itself. A kidney looks like a kidney. A lung looks like a lung. Nobody knows what the language organ looks like.
As a linguist, I think Chomsky is so famous and so highly cited in the academic literature for his takedown decades ago of the famous behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner.
Exactly.
So Chomsky was, I think, also focused on the centrality of speech in developing human behavior, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, he put a big – but he thought – that it was part of – he thought it was part of evolution, that it was built into – somehow built into the human body. And I think that it's so far-fetched. And I believe in my evidence. but he's a great figure. A lot of people have tried to oppose him within the scientific world, and they really don't get anywhere. He really has that quality of – charisma. Noam says it, that must be true.
So if you're not a religionist, you're not a creationist, mm-hmm. And you don't believe in the science of evolution, mm-hmm. where do you think human beings came from?
I think we don't know. And that, so much of the craziness of the theory of the theory of evolution is due to the fact that there's no evidence for what may have happened 4 million years ago. People come up with theories of what happened 4 million years ago, but there's no evidence. There's no evidence how speech began either.
They would say, I had a scientist on the show not too long ago who was talking about, a certain set of fossils that were found that seemed to indicate some of the steps along the way from one species to another towards humanity. So they would say there's a lot of evidence, physical evidence.
Well, when you think about it, what are fossils? That's the remains of what was a complicated creature. And all the meat is gone, all the evidence of the workings of the brain are gone. There's another theory of a kind of theory of evolution that says that these species die out and they are replaced by other species. So it's not that one develops into another, but that there are a whole other series. And the fact is we don't know. This all happens so far back in an undiscoverable past.
So scientists back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
Tom Wolfe is my guest on WNYC. His new book is called The Kingdom of Speech. Could I look back with you a little bit? You're often credited with being one of the creators of the field of what was at the time called New Journalism.
Yes.
Which incorporated literary techniques, the style of novels, also more first person within the context of journalism. Many of these things have really become standard for long form nonfiction writing and uncontroversial today. Do you think journalism is better for the change?
Oh, I think it's much better, but I don't see a great deal of it anymore. A lot of editors, it can turn out very badly, but a lot of editors just shy away from it. And there's no place to turn to now to see it used. It's based on a very simple set of techniques. One is extended dialogue. Dialogue is the easiest thing to read. And this was proved in a Teachers College, Columbia, in a famous test. Also, scene-by-scene construction. In other words, instead of having going from a scene to a passage of sheer essay, and then maybe you pick up another scene, you try to develop the entire thing in scenes. And there's what I call the notation of status detail. You know, there's so many ways that people reveal their desires to rise up in the world. And in print, it's easy to use. For example, if somebody's wearing a pair of Gucci loafers as opposed to a pair of Tom McCann loafers, you can, in half a sentence, you can get this across. But in film, on television, for example, you would have to stop, and somebody has to give a little dissertation about these two pairs of shoes, and also the interior monologue. Now, that's very tricky to use in nonfiction, and people like myself and Gay Talese, for that matter, put a great emphasis on all of this being accurate. And it drove me crazy when I was writing about the astronauts and the right stuff. I didn't know what they were saying half the time because they were up in space. Part of it was made public.
So the internal dialogue, like thought bubbles.
Right. Exactly. And these four things really are what bring fiction alive. But if you work hard enough at it, you can find the same things in nonfiction. You just can't manipulate the plot.
You always, I think, you reveled some in sticking your finger in the eye of the liberal intelligentsia a little bit, though you traveled in those circles. Did you get a certain un-PC glee from some of what you wrote?
Well, to tell the truth, I did, and I continue to. The intellectual, by definition now, is somebody who has generally, they don't have to be extreme, just generally left leanings, a suspicion of whoever happens to be in power, which is probably healthy. But it leads people to all the crazed forms of political correctness that for the latest I've heard of is that it is definitely a violation of political correctness to say to a group of young men and women, "Well, I'll see you guys later. See you around around here." And my God, including the word "guys" or to include women. Well, actually, I'm even thinking of doing a book on, making my next book on political correctness. Uh-huh. It's such a wide open, wild, crazed field, and it's quite different from the kind of Marxist, generally speaking, form of political correctness in the 1960s.
Of course, Trump is running against PC as one of the hearts of his campaign. You voting for him?
You know, this is the craziest election I've ever seen here. You couldn't have picked two more unpopular candidates, and it's immoral that Trump has gone as far as he has. But he's done it by being politically incorrect, and all the people who feel a certain way about illegal immigrants or about Muslims, saying, yeah, someone's finally said it. And he still picks up a following that way. And I think he's quite aware of that.
Do you know him, by the way, both long-term New Yorkers?
No, I've never met him. And when you think about it, his ties within the power structure or even the business structure in New York are not very deep. In fact, Nobody knows how much money he has. He's been very canny about not revealing it, but always indicating that a vast sum. But I was once chosen to be a part of a speaking group. There was a company, I can't remember the name, it was having an annual meeting in New York. And so the first night at the dinner, after dinner speaker, they had Donald Trump. The second night they had, I'm vain enough to admit this, me. And the third night was Carl Icahn. So I remark, at this point, Trump had, one of his big companies had gone bankrupt. And so I said, you may not know this, but these evening programs were arranged in order of wealth. I said, Donald Trump's just went deep into bankruptcy. I figure his net worth is about minus $300 million.
He should have gone first.
He said, I've worked all my life and I've saved up $20,000. And I assume Carl Icahn has more than that. And I don't think I did not get riotous laughter.
So I know you raised some eyebrows in the literary world when you said you were voting for Bush in the 2004 election. Are you undecided?
I am undecided. I really haven't. But I'm determined to vote. I'm not going to skip it. A lot of people are thinking about liberationist
philosophy. The libertarian?
Libertarian, I mean, without having a foggiest idea of really what it is. So you make it whatever you want. That was what Peter Thiel had called himself, a libertarian. Before he came out for Trump at the Republican National Convention.
Tom Wolfe's new book is The Kingdom of Speech. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me on, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll check in on the presidential race next, particularly how Clinton and Trump are reacting to the bombings and bombing attempts here in New York and New Jersey over the recent days. Stay with us.